Greetings, this is the Click podcast for Tuesday the 8th of July 2014. This is Gareth Mitchell with you at the moment, because Bill Thompson, regular expert Bill Thompson, he's away this week and next week. We are going to be meeting another expert in the programme in a few moments, but as for the podcast intro, what should we do next? I think we should just have the programme. Here it is. Greetings, everybody, and welcome to this special edition of Click. I'm Gareth Mitchell, and today we're talking about electronic music. And you might be thinking, OK, they're going to be talking about synthesizers, or maybe how recording artists are creating music these days. We could be talking about downloads, all those kinds of things. But this is more about novel ways of making music. In fact, a whole festival, a whole conference here in London devoted to the subject this week. I am with the convener, Atau Tanaka, who is also a professor of media computing at Goldsmiths University of London. They're hosting this event. Atau, this event is called NIME, which is N-I-M-E. That's how it's spelled. What does it stand for?
So NIME is an acronym that stands for New Interfaces for Musical Expression. Music is an art form that's always had this sort of dual edge, let's say. Music is for everyone. Everyone can hum a tune, but playing a musical instrument is a very difficult thing that requires practice. And in between, the science of musical instrument, of acoustics, etc., music has always required maths. And now music technology and new interfaces for performing with music are both expressive in that public way and scientific in that research way.
And I've sat on stage and watched you perform right next to me, wired up with lots of sensors that look at your body and how it moves in order to create music. And it struck me then that the body itself is becoming the interface for music. It's not just kind of using your hands or blowing into a pipe anymore.
So when we think about electronic music, we think about people behind a laptop computer or increasingly apps on your smartphone that can remix tracks and so forth. But what we'd like to think about in the interfaces for NIME are ways to engage the human body. Now, this is rapidly becoming into the public consciousness with products like the Microsoft Kinect. You can play video games by moving your body around. We have, in the research area, even more advanced interfaces that can pick up, as you know in my case, the electrical impulses of the muscle to become expressive input to a digital music system.
And just finally, what kinds of technologies might I be encountering as I walk around this festival? What are the big interface technologies that are being used at the moment?
They can be sensor technologies that pick up movement. They can be GPS technologies that pick up location. They can be networked, mobile, physiological. They can be a high-end lab kit, or they can be a really accessible DIY solder-it-yourself kit.
Atau Tanaka there, and we'll hear more from him in a little while. But also here we have LJ Rich. I'm not with Bill Thompson, who's our usual expert this week, but LJ, you are more than qualified to be our expert on this programme because you are on Click, the TV programme, our sister show. Why should people care about new forms of interfaces for musical expression? They might say we have piano keyboards, we have stringed instruments, all these different things. Why do we need electronic novel interfaces?
If you play the piano, you will create a particular kind of tune. If you play a guitar or bagpipes, the tunes you will create will be different based on how you interact with the instrument. So depending on what you're doing, you could create new compositional elements. For example, on a guitar, there's loads of different places where middle C is, but it means that people compose differently. So that's the musical answer. The non-musical answer is that there are applications outside of music. There was a professor in Plymouth University. He created a musical interface where you would stare at a checkered pattern, and then that signal would generate a signal in your visual cortex, which would then send out a sympathetic electrical signal that would get a cello player to play a phrase of music. People with locked-in syndrome can now use this same interface to communicate by using their eyes to look at a particular pattern. So there are applications outside of the music sphere where only creativity can kind of bridge that gap that technology normally has waiting for us to jump over.
So LJ, we'll have more from you as we go along, including, in fact, I'm looking forward to hearing this, your own experimentation with a musical interface. For me, well, there's a lot to see and to hear over here, so I'm going to go and do just that. So we've just been listening to that performance by the cellist and dancer Seth Parker Woods. And now we've sneaked backstage. You're just getting your breath back after a performance that included cello playing and dancing and also some technology. And indeed, also with you is Ian Hatwick. He's with McGill University in Montreal, and you're an instrument maker and composer and obviously a technologist in this context, because we should explain that on stage, Seth was wearing what to me looked like an exospine. Imagine he'd had surgery and we had to remove his spine and put it outside his body instead of inside. It kind of looked like that, and it was illuminated on an otherwise quite dark stage. Tell us a bit more about this musical exospine.
The idea of using, you know, performing dance with sensors or technology is pretty established. A lot of people have done it. We wanted a device that they would work with physically, changes the way that they move and changes the way that they perceive their interaction with the instrument, while at the same time creating music in real time.
And there are moments, Seth, where you're arching your back and you're going into these incredible maneuvers, and we can see it because the spine is lit. We can see how it flexes and bends with your own body movements. Presumably that's how you're controlling the music that we can hear.
So there's a series of sensors as well as a radio signal that's being connected back to the computer and then run via Mac's MSP patch. It's making basically a mapping, basically, of what I'm doing from move to move, bend and twisting on an X, Y, and beta axis. And then that's all then recontrolled and manipulated by Ian over here.
To me, though, the biggest challenge isn't technological. The biggest challenge is aesthetic and artistic. Like, how are we going to use this instrument in a way that isn't just a demo or isn't just sort of an example of how we can use technology? There's a reason for why we're using technology, and until we see it used in performance by an expert performer, it's almost not worth anything.
So back now with event organizer Atal Tanaka, and from the confines of the venue itself, you've brought us over the road into this park. What are we doing here in this kind of urban space with the sound of this construction site behind us as well?
What I'd like to show you, Gareth, is a piece by Kath Matthews called The Pedaling Games, and indeed it takes interactive music out of the concert hall and into a public park here in Lewisham. We've got six bicycles that the composer Kath Matthews has loaded up with GPS systems. So as you ride around the bicycles, she is creating location-aware music.
Okay, right. Right, so I've taken to one of these bicycles, and it's a bit of a wobbly start, but yeah, we're underway. And I'm just pedaling my way into the park. I'm just narrowly avoiding a park bench, and there's a tree to my right-hand side here. And, well, this is what I can hear. There's actually a running track here in the park, so I'm just crossing that running track, and you can hear how the sound is changing. But as I ride along, it just occurs to me, I'm kind of questioning whether I'm... Does this make me a musician? Does it make me a cyclist? Does it make me an audience member, maybe? Well, I think I need to hop off this bike and speak to the person who's put all this together. Kath Matthews is the artist and designer who's constructed all this. It's an art piece. It's called The Pedaling Games. So what are you pedaling?
The bicycle is a yellow hired bicycle from Ghent. And on the bicycle is a pair of yellow speakers, stereo speakers at the front. On the back is a large black box containing a BeagleBoard computer, a car stereo amplifier, a 12-volt motorbike battery, and a GPS receiver, and a piece of mapping software that I use to link different audio files to different locations within the site that I'm working in. And in this situation, we're in Fordham Park.
So the idea is that I've just been cycling around so I can hear these sounds and they relate to where I am in the park. You're mapping the park, in a sense, through sound, aren't you?
I'm interested you call this an art piece. For me, this is a composition. I'm actually a composer, if you like. but I need and want to get music out of the confines of the concert hall and more into the laps, the ears, the lives of your regular people on the street. It's actually looking at a bicycle as a means of cruising through the landscape very slowly, very comfortably, but being able to listen. And what it does, it actually transforms the landscape. So people, if they're cycling down a street or across a park, with what they're hearing, it becomes completely changed. And they have really good fun, and they get really relaxed, and maybe have experiences they wouldn't have had before.
My name is Todor Todorov. I'm an electrical engineer, I'm a composer, I'm a performer, and I do develop sound interfaces, sensors, that I've been using in the performance called Evanescence. I work with Laura Colmenares-Guerra, who's the video artist, and with Sigrid van den Burgaarde, who's the cellist. So the cello is center stage. Then on one side, you have the video artist who actually performs part of the video live. On the other side, you find me who performs a part of the electroacoustic sound live. But we both receive information from the sensors. I do also analysis on the sound of the acoustical sound of the cello, and those information I used and mapped into sound transformation algorithms on one side and sent to the video computer on the other side. So we actually have synchronized sound and video depending on how the cellist performs. This is the kind of technology that has matured over the years. I think this conference shows a lot of technologies that are becoming actually mainstream.
So the kind of things that are going on in this conference are almost doing for the music that we have at the moment, for contemporary music, what Moog was doing when the first synthesizers came in 50 years ago.
Those sensors that I'm using, basically they are based on accelerometers, gyroscopes, magnetometers. You know, those technologies were not really available more than 10 years ago. Accelerometer came by thanks to airbags, because you needed to have millions of accelerometers to trigger the airbags in cars, so the prices went down. And all this technology becomes affordable, so more people use them, and there's a progress in the way to use it musically.
Now, two of the performers here who have graced the airwaves of our very programme as well on Click are Sarah Anglis and Stephen Hiscock, and they've been performing here. And Stephen, maybe we could start with you. Just tell us about what was included in your performance.
We had a theremin, which is one of the oldest of the electronic instruments, and we had a set of six bells, which are actually Victorian bells used for bell ringing in churches. And we hung these six bells on a stand, and we put them through motion sensors, and we played the theremin, we looped things. So it's very much a mixture of analog and digital.
Right, so one of the principal instruments in the performance is the theremin. Of course, Sarah, the instrument that famously musicians move their hands around, and it converts those into sound. So very much an early example of an interface for musical expression.
We had an IMU, a little motion sensor, on one of the bells, and that was affecting the sounds that you were hearing. Similarly, Stephen had a sort of theremin-like setup on his bell stand, and so what we wanted people to see was that when I made a gesture, then Stephen could make a sort of similar gesture and create a similar effect. So one of us was affecting the bells, one of us was affecting the theremin, and we had things like the gestures on the bells affecting what the theremin played and the gestures on the theremin affecting what the bells played. It's getting the balance between the two, and that's what it's always like when you're on stage with technology, I think.
Where do you see this going in terms of your own development? I suppose both of you, you're musicians, you're performers, you're composers, but you're kind of R&D people as well, you know, you're hackers. So where is this taking you, do you think, Sarah?
Well, it's sort of analog meets digital, because it's about exploiting these things with real world instruments. That's what excites me. And, you know, there was these devices called IMUs, the sorts of things they used, you know, in head-up displays, so that the picture moves as the pilot moves their head. And you can now buy these for £20 and link them up to a really cheap microcontroller that you can just, you know, buy on the internet. and link that up to your computer. And so now we've reached the point where this thing that was in a head-up display, you can now buy, say, 7 of them and put them in a peal of bells. And then that's very exciting because bells, it used to be that you'd strike a bell and there was this long tail and you couldn't do much with it except possibly wave your arms around to create a bit of Doppler shift. But now, if we can sense the motion of the bell, then you can manipulate what you do to the amplified long tail as you move the bells. And that's about the fact that this stuff has become so cheap and so easy to sort of hook up to each other.
Well, this is a special edition of Click. I'm Gareth Mitchell. We're here on the BBC World Service, and I'm reporting from Goldsmiths University, and they have a conference all about new interfaces in musical expression. Now, our expert this week, Bill is not here, but I am with LJ Rich. And LJ, actually, you bring a bit of your own experimentation with interfaces in music here through something that you call glitching. What is that?
Glitching is a way to mess with the auditory reality that we see and hear around us. For me, everything is musical as soon as you hear it. And it's all born of this synesthesia that I was born with, I guess. I translate things into music very easily. For a lot of people, though, repeated listening can create that illusion of song. Professor Diana Deutsch, a psychology professor, noted this in the mid-90s with something called the speech-to-song illusion, where something repeated more and more becomes more and more tuneful. So I've taken that idea, brought in some modern technology, and built the most almighty, monstrous, sellotaped together, over-engineered, fantastically insane device that allows us to experience the world in real time, made more musical by technology. So I've got a MacBook Pro on my back. That's running 3 programs at once. Meanwhile, I've got special microphone earphones that are plugged in to a device that then plugs into the computer. On my wrist, I'm wearing an iPod Touch, which is effectively remote controlling the computer. Now, the audio sounds are being manipulated inside the music program. So I'm adding sort of echo and weird kind of wonderful sound effects. And finally, I've got a small portable iRig Keys MIDI keyboard that's also plugged into my back. Eventually, I'm going to make an app that does this.
And now we're having a demo. So basically, you've plugged it all in. I've taken one of your FM radios, which just allows me to hear essentially a transmission of what's being created through this music sonification synesthesia exploration device. So let's try it out.
Now you can hear. Now you're around. Now you're around. Now you're around. 3D sound. 3D sound. Final sound. Final sound. Now, on my wrist, on my wrist, what do you think?
I think it's amazing. I'm really getting a sense of the musicality of people just speaking. It's very dreamlike. LJ, I'm going to have to wake myself up from this reverie. There is more to see and hear here. But thank you so much for letting me share your synesthesia.
It's a pleasure. I'm glad it worked.
We're watching a recital. There's a beautiful grand piano in this otherwise darkened room. But what you're listening to is actually not somebody playing the piano. Well, it kind of is somebody playing the piano, but in a previous life. So we stand here with the impression that the piano is almost playing itself. It's a piece of work, by the way, I should say. It's called Mirror Fugue. And the artist, the designer, is Xiao Xiao, and you're with the MIT Media Lab as well. Tell us about the work itself. So I've mentioned that the piano appears to be playing itself, and yet projected onto the piano is an almost ghostly figure.
We have a Yamaha Disclavier here, which is a player piano, like the modern version. What's happening is that I'm projecting a video of a pianist's hands onto the keyboard, so it's projection mapped there. It's synchronized with the player piano so that it actually looks like the projected hands are playing the keys with the real sounds coming out of the piano. And in the meanwhile, I've modified the music stand part of this grand piano so that I can project on it. And on here, I've projected the upper body of the pianist.
What is it, I suppose, trying to say? Is it an opportunity to reflect on the nature of performance or the idea that the performance is a fleeting thing and yet in this sense it can be captured? What are you trying to say?
There is something really poignant about it. These days, when we think about listening to music, especially for classical music, there's this culture of you want every note to be perfect. You have to, like, capture the pure idea of it. And the human becomes, like, a vehicle in order to get the idealized version of the piece. But historically, and if you look at cultures where there's more of, like, an oral performative culture, it's not about the perfection, but it's about the communication, about the experience of playing music for someone. And so a part of this piece is also just the beauty of seeing different people play different sorts of music. Like, you feel like there's a person there and they're trying to say something.
Now, not only is there a lot of performance, as you'd expect at an event like this, yes, but there are a number of talks. And there's a keynote later in the conference from Hiroshi Ishii, who's with MIT Media Lab in Massachusetts, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And, Arisha, you're very interested in the whole idea of almost making digital technology, of making it visual in lots of unexpected ways, the idea that structures change their form according to information that is received, mm-hmm, and so on. We can sum this up under the idea of the tangible bit. Yep. So what do you mean by the tangible bit?
My approach is to make information, computation, really physical, graspable, touchable, so that people can use all the tactile sensations, precise controls, tactile feedback. There's no ambiguity. You grab it, you immediately get all the feedback from your skin. So that is missing in the current digital pixel-based interface.
As for this event, yeah, how does it cut across from the academic world, and there are many academics here, to the world outside, as it were?
NIMES is on the border or edge, crossing between technology and the music. So I do believe always the border has energy. Science, technology, and art design, and the business has a whole different paradigms and barriers. But I hope Naimish culture really destroy all these barriers.
Well, we feel very privileged because we've managed to essentially gate crash a sound check. This is Letitia Sodami, who is, I'm going to embarrass you here, but you are one of the pioneers, if not the pioneer, of this whole field of gestural control of music and of wearable technology for performing music. This is a sound check ahead of your show this evening. Can you just explain to us what you're actually wearing, how you're making this happen?
It's called the lady's glove, and what it is this very elegant black lycra glove, and it has a variety of sensors that track the speed of the hand, the distance of the hands to the ground, and the distance between both hands and the bending of the finger. So there's about 30 different sensors that come in into the computer and that are then being mapped to control the sounds in real time. So, you know, you're kind of swimming in this pool of sounds, and I can pull some out, and it's like, in a way, storytelling with the hand. One of the interesting things with the gestural controller, which I found out as I was doing it, is that you're also introducing a strange logic that you're not really expecting, because you know, as you move, something happens, and then your body moves. So you're kind of attracted towards certain territories that you might not have thought about because the body gets involved.
And you're quite critical of this whole idea of wearable technology as a means of controlling devices, aren't you? Just tell me what you mean by that.
I see a lot of people wanting to create systems that do what they want and control. And I think that the technology allows us not to explore the unknown and to discover new relationships and to do things that we might not have envisioned. I think that also when you look at the development of wearables, it's really something that the army has really taken on. You know, and then you have the Google glasses, and you have all these things that people are starting to wear to some kind of have a better sense of the world and community. And so I'm just thinking, well, I guess for us, we need to go somewhere else. You know, we can't really do this. And as artists, the field is some kind of occupied by corporations.
You're famous for the lady's glove with its sensors on, but you have another device here on stage. I don't know if we can look at this. And is it maybe a sign of your musical progression and your technological progression?
Or maybe it's a sign of old age, because I can't sit in front of it.
You're not that old. I know. You've been doing this for a while.
I know, but I'm preparing my retirement. You know, it takes 20 years to know what something... It took me 25 years to get the glove going, so I'm giving myself a little time, you know. Pretty much what it is that it's trying to explore this idea of chaos. Okay, I'm going to describe it. It's using springs that are being picked up with this... little audio pickups that I hacked from reverb tanks. And then the audio signal is being analyzed through the neural networks that Rebecca Fiebring designed. And then this analysis is then controlling the sound. But because I'm using something that is pretty much uncontrollable, it never really gets to what it's supposed to do. So it goes in between, it tries to learn things, but it cannot really learn. So then I get to hear sounds that are new to me, and then I try to play with it.
Okay, well, it is nearly time for us to leave this event, but just before we do, a final few words with LJ Rich, who's been our expert today. Coming in today, myself, wearing my jaded journalist, slightly cynical hat, I wondered if I was actually going to experience any music. I thought there'd be some technology, and we'd all get excited about that. But there has been genuine virtuosity here. You know, for instance, Seth, the cellist and performer and dancer I saw earlier on, is classically trained. I enjoyed some virtuoso cello playing, albeit augmented, adorned, accompanied by the technology that he's working with as well.
I think there's no substitute for virtuosity, talent and passion. Those things, technology can perhaps augment, but at the moment, we're not at a point where technology can completely replace virtuosity and passion. Although there are some really interesting things like David Cope's generative music that can make Bach. Bach had to exist in order for him to make the fake computer-generated Bach. So I think we've still got space for virtuosity, which I'm really happy about.
Indeed. Well, on that note, no pun intended, we will leave it. LJ Rich, it's been a pleasure working with you again. Thank you very much indeed for you out there in Radioland for listening to us. I'm Gareth Mitchell. The producer is Colin Grant, and we'll be back in the studio next week. See you then. Bye-bye. And that was our very musical special edition from here at Goldsmith. Now, just before I come home, there's a little bit more business to do, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, this is the podcast outro. And we don't have Bill, but luckily we have you and your comments. You've been letting us know, especially about the story that we covered in last week's programme about Facebook. And this was this rather controversial study where they looked at how people's news feeds affected what they then went on to write in their own updates on their profiles. So this was a study in over 500,000 users. And it was controversial because they didn't seek people's consent first. So we had a few comments in the programme on the day, but a few more have come in since. On Facebook, yes, I'm aware of the irony. Mark Scholes says, yes, but already Facebook affect all these people with their current algorithms. Just they don't know how. The effect the study documents is very small, as little as 0.1% of an observed change. And that's a good point, Mark. I'd heard that argument a little bit last week around the whole storm around this whole issue. But people were kind of saying, well, even a small effect, when you're talking about a user base of hundreds of millions of people, that still, you know, might be a proportionately small effect, but it can lead, obviously, to quite a large effect when you multiply it up across a lot of users. Gordon Jolly says the change in news feeds will have affected vulnerable people, a handful maybe, negatively. You can't ignore that possibility. And, of course, we had that contribution from a journalist in last week's programme who indeed kind of agreed with that point, saying that... even slightly negative results in a news feed could be enough to affect her depressive disorder. Anna Violetta says we're responsible for our consumption. We use Facebook by choice. But that doesn't mean Facebook has no responsibilities to its users. They know exactly what they're doing. John Wilson says, is it unacceptable for a company to try out changes to their application on a small number of users without telling them before finalising and releasing the changes to all users? I think he's implying that just kind of happens all the time. He said that is also a social experiment. And Steve Leahy on Twitter this time says, I find it amusing that only now are Facebook users finding it creepy and disturbing. So generally some critical responses from some of you. Other people in the run-up to the broadcast last week were kind of saying, OK, what's all the fuss about?
Is it really a bit of a storm in a teacup? I'm sure it's a discussion that will continue, but that is it for us here on what is now a glorious, sunny, early evening here in Goldsmiths. It's time to go home. I'll be back in the studio. We'll have more from LJ, actually, next week. So I'll see you then. Bye-bye.